Inspired by IMDb and Sight and Sound, Return of the Disc presents the Top 250 Movies List, a miniseries.
Well, what a way to kick off our penultimate episode 9 of the Top 250 Films. Joining me again is Tom, as always, and hello. I'm excited to really get into the Top 50 today. And where should we start?
You want to? I think I started last time. Do you want to start?
Sure.
Do it.
Number 50 on my list is The Godfather.
Ooh.
I appreciate The Godfather more and more each watch. It's a fantastic film. Recently, I watched it again on this 4K, and it looks amazing. It was a completely new experience. You know, as older I get, the more I understand the themes. And just what a complex character arc that Michael goes through. And Al Pacino was perfect for the role. Hands down, just fantastic casting all around. Marlon Brando is excellent, of course. And just a classic. And I do prefer it over the sequel. Next one is 49. One that I had to put in here. I don't think necessarily it's probably 49, but unfortunately I had a repeat at this slot. And I was like, well, I'm in a panicking. Do I go this direction? Do I go that direction? And I was like, well, I watched this movie 3 times in the past year. So it's got to mean something. And that is The Quick and the Dead. Sam Raimi's Western. Highly stylized. I would say this is his spaghetti Western. It's basically a video game where they have this contest of duels and have all these different characters meet in the contest. And Gene Hackman runs the contest. Sharon Stone is amazing as the lead. Russell Crowe is great in here. But it's Leonardo DiCaprio. He really steals every scene that he's in. A young Leonardo DiCaprio. And, you know, he would go on to do Titanic after this and all and blow up as a mega star. I just thought, you know, Sam Raimi has some interesting camera angles and he has the Raimi style into a Western. And I really enjoy this movie. And it's not the best Western, but it's really entertaining.
Oh, yeah.
Number 48 is one that I don't actually own because the 4K is not good. And I just, for some reason, never had it on Blu-ray. And I got rid of my DVD at some point. But I think it's one of the best sequels ever made. Terminator 2, Judgment Day. So in its place, I have the first Terminator here. But I love Terminator 2, Judgment Day. Twisting it, making, you know, Arnold a hero in this one was genius by James Cameron. And everything's elevated from the first one. The effects are still groundbreaking as far as the villain, the liquid metal and all that. And just a fantastic ending to what it should have been, the ending of the whole Terminator franchise, in my opinion. It's just a great ending. Thumbs up. And we're done. But they kept making them. 47 is a feel-good movie about race relations, based on a true story, Remember the Titans, fantastic portrayal by Denzel Washington as the coach, Herman Boone, he's put into an impossible situation where there's a lot of prejudice against black people and racism in the town, and they really overcome it through football. And the team really rallies around each other, black and white, get along, and that kind of sets the example for the town to get over their prejudices. So I really enjoy watching this one. It's an easy watch, and it's impactful.
Hell yeah.
Also has a great soundtrack. Number 46 is A Long Time Ago in a Galaxy Far, Far Away, the original Star Wars. Again, it's one that grew on me over the years. I usually gravitate towards the other Star Wars films, but the original still holds up. You know, it sets up that classic hero's journey. You have Luke looking over at the suns to the John Williams music, you know, swelling over, and it's for all the dreamers. And then you have the nice Harrison Ford as Han Solo, Carrie Fisher, Princess Leia, Rescue Mission, fun sci-fi, robots. I mean, it changed the game.
Oh, yeah.
All right, Tom, that's my first five, I believe.
Cool.
I think I did five, yeah.
All right.
What do you got?
My number 50 is An American Werewolf in London. Jan Landis directs the story of David Naughton as a young American tourist to England, bitten by a werewolf and falling in love with his nurse as he transforms into a monster. Devilishly funny, yet still incredibly dark, amazing creature effects by Rick Baker, and an incredibly committed performance by Naughton. I don't feel like he gets enough credit for this one, because he didn't do a ton of movies, but holy shit. I mean, like, Landis asked a really lot of him in this one.
Yeah. It is outrageous. I expected Griffin Dunn to hang around more, but I mean, he's still in it, but it's just crazy what happens.
Yeah. Well, and David Naughton is naked a really lot. Like, when I rewatched it, I was like, oh,
yeah, wow. He's very vulnerable.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, like, he's even naked during the transformation scene, which, like, oh, that's still painful to watch.
You know, that probably took a couple days to shoot.
Exactly, too. Yeah. It showed up on 101 Scariest Movie Moments, a series on Shudder, where they were talking about that, and they talked about the nightmare sequence in the middle of the film, which I had never really thought about in depth until they started talking about it. Like, I thought the scene was fine, but the most horrific scene for me is the werewolf transformation, but they'd already had a couple werewolf transformations on, so I think that's why they chose that scene. But anyway, they pointed out that, like, so in the scene, it's his parents and sister, and then, like, they're watching the Muppets, and then a bunch of, like, monstrous Nazis show up at the door and start killing everybody with machine guns. And they pointed out in there that, like, as he is Jewish, this is the only way that his subconscious can understand, can give him, like, images of, like, what is happening to him, that he is turning into a monster. And I was like, that is actually pretty brilliant. I never, like, read it that way. I never realized that. So there's a lot of nuance to the movie.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good pick.
Number 49 is Inglourious Basterds. Quentin Tarantino takes a Nazi exploitation with an ensemble cast led by Brad Pitt and a plot to assassinate Hitler in a movie premiere. Christoph Waltz shines as a scheming Nazi Jew hunter. And yeah, this one's good.
It is.
I knew that they, I don't think there's anyone who knows that doesn't know that, like, they kill Hitler at the end of that movie. And when I heard that, I was like, well, I need to see that movie. Like, what?
Oh, you didn't see it in theaters?
No, I didn't see it in theaters. My first Tarantino movie in theaters was Django Unchained.
Okay, and Bastards was mine.
Oh, okay. So number 48 is Fantasia. Disney brings us animation set to classical music. Some of the most iconic scenes from the company are in this film. The Dance of the Hours with the hippopotamus in a tutu under attack from crocodiles. Mickey bringing brooms to life in The Sorcerer's Apprentice, the devil making his demons dance in A Night on Bald Mountain, until the far right got upset and it officially became Chernobog. I don't think he's on the cover. Oh, wait, he's back here. That's not the devil. That is Chernobog. Number 47 is one that you already had. Lawrence of Arabia. David Lean's masterpiece follows Peter O'Toole as T.E. Lawrence, a British officer who aided the Arab tribes in World War I. An epic picture. I love that O'Toole plays the role as gay/autistic. White actors in brown face mars the movie. Number 46 is Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, an incredible animated movie from Chris Miller and Phil Lord. Miles Morales becomes Spider-Man in a multiverse-blending plot. Very fun. I saw it 5 times in theaters, several of them in 3D. One of the few times I feel 3D was well used. So that was my first 5. Wow. Yeah, I saw it 3 times in 3D.
It's pretty crazy, man. I mean, it's good. They definitely use the 3D well, and it works perfectly with the animation style.
Oh, for sure. I'll probably see the new ones in 3D too. But yeah, I just love that one. Like, literally, like, I saw it, like, I was bringing everybody to it. I was like, hey, come on, let's go.
I know how that goes. Okay, my 45 is, I would consider it a B-movie. It's a lot of fun. Predator. Arnold Schwarzenegger, the original Predator.
It's a big budget B-movie.
Yeah, it really is. It's a big budget B-movie, monster, sci-fi, survival film. Had the famous gif with Arnold and Carl Weathers grabbing hands together, you know, bro. And Jesse Ventura is in this. It's just Bill Duke's in it. There's a lot of great 80s action stars in this movie. And a lot of them die in gruesome ways. It's really lovely. Yeah, pretty much. I just enjoy the heck out of this film. It's one of my favorite. It's really good. It's probably the best one out of the Predator franchise for sure.
Oh, for sure. I mean, that's the only one that ended up on my list. That being said, I do like 2 Predators and Prey. I don't really like the Predator, but the other sequels are good. Or at least okay.
Well, this film also got a sequel on my number 44. I got a sequel a couple years ago, Rolling with Jesus, but the original is always better, The Big Lebowski.
We're very close on this one.
A classic. I didn't understand the film first viewing, and I think that's normal for this film. It's a unique piece of art. But when you narrow it down to maybe like this detective story where Lebowski is our detective, and he's thrown into this situation of misunderstanding, and he has to basically solve the crime, and you see it through that way, it's like, holy crap, this movie changed dramatically for me and has grown on me ever since. I just get more out of it. It's kind of like its own little slice of, I don't know, it's very Coen Brothers. It's just, it's a movie that is just impactful. Like, every single line in the script is almost quotable. Mm-hmm. And you have a great turn here by Philip Seymour Hoffman too, and then you have Jeff Bridges is great as a dude, John Goodman is fantastic as an ex-Vietnam guy, and then they're hanging out with Donnie, played by Steve Buscemi, who's just clueless, and it's just, but you feel for him, like you like him, and then so yeah, I just really enjoy The Big Lebowski, and I do love the Steelbook.
Yeah.
Number 43 is the sequel to Star Wars, one of the greatest sequels ever made, The Empire Strikes Back. The stakes are really heavy in this one, and the epic reveal of I Am Your Father. I can only imagine seeing this in 1980 and having to wait 3 years, what that would have felt like is, I don't know, it would have been crazy. But The Empire Strikes Back is still, to me, the best Star Wars film we've had. And yeah, I mean, you know it's really good when Lucas didn't go back and edit much of the film, because this is the one that he didn't add the most stuff to, or animals and gadgets and whatever stuff. Because he added like a musical number in Return of the Jedi.
And the musical number is there. It's just he added the weird CGI thing.
No, dude, it's not there. It's not.
Yeah, it is.
It is.
Yeah, I mean, it was a puppet initially.
No way.
I don't know. It's in the despecialized edition as a puppet. So I don't know. I don't know what to tell you.
Maybe. But it's so distracting. In the, it's a new song, though, at least. It's like it's.
It might have been. I don't know about something.
That. Anyways.
It was bad.
It doesn't matter. But I don't like Return of the Jedi as much as these two, but It's good, but it's not like it's a fine ending. I don't know. I just have some issues with it. But Return of the Empire Strikes Back, though, is just fantastic.
Oh, yeah. The first two films are almost perfect.
Yeah. My next one, number 42, is another just a fantastic film by Steven Spielberg. Honestly, it might be overlooked now, but I tend to really love it. Close Encounters of the Third Kind. It's just, it's insane the paranoia that Richard Dreyfuss has in this film. And the way that it ends, at least in the theatrical version, just great. I mean, there's like three versions of this now.
There are.
And Spielberg even said that he wouldn't have done what he did. He wouldn't have ended it the same way. He would have had Dreyfuss's character stay on Earth instead of go. But I think it works better when he leaves, because he's so determined to, like, he like ignores everything and he's obsessed with this, like, the messages from outer space, and he becomes so much so he builds like a freaking pile of dirt in his house and like he like recreates the mountain and stuff.
Yeah. I didn't know there was a version of that movie where he doesn't leave. Like, it makes sense with his character arc. I don't know.
Yeah, it's an interesting take. But yeah, there's several scenes that are added or taken away, and it depends on the cut. But I, you know, it's just a fantastic film.
Oh yeah.
I got another good one for you here, number 41. This is arguably, some people didn't like this film as much as others. I'll say I really enjoyed this one. I think it's up there with the original, and it really is becoming more and more apparent that we're headed in this direction as far as AI and just where we're going is Blade Runner 2049. Love this movie. Had a great time in theaters. I just think that Denis Villeneuve, this is his best film by far for me. The way that he builds the atmosphere. This was an impossible movie to make. To have a sequel to a cult classic that was like messed with and re-edited and had different versions and didn't have the final cut to like 2014 of Blade Runner. And to come out with the sequel of that, the only thing is it didn't make any money like the original. So there's fans of this universe, but I don't know how many fans there really are. But it's definitely, if you're a Blade Runner fan, you're a Blade Runner fan. And Blade Runner 2049, I think, is a fitting sequel that I really enjoy. I think Ryan Gosling nails it, and he's looking for his identity. He wants to be human, wants to have human interaction. He has an AI. He falls in love with the AI, pretty much, which is what we're heading to as a society. People falling in love with AI. And I don't know. There's a lot of interesting themes in this one. And I love the score as well. It's just a great... actually, I thought it was more accessible for people that are new to Blade Runner than the original, because the original is more abstract. And it's not exactly clear what is going on. Like, whereas 2049 is like, you're in this detective, you're trying to figure out where Deckard is on some point. And then you meet Deckard, and Deckard's looking for, he has his backstory, why he's in isolation and all that. And then this is search for his daughter. And so it's more straightforward than the original, but I think it works. So if you're new to the Blade Runner franchise, I would say probably start with this one. Honestly, you don't have to really watch the original. All right, back to you.
I hope they do an alternate cut of that
movie. Also, I have to say, I have a memory of shooting a movie during this time when we all went and saw this movie together. So I had a lot of fun. That experience I will remember. So some of us didn't like the film as others, but we were all there. That's the important thing. So
I was very vocal about not liking it.
Yeah. You were, but it's okay. Still love you.
That's good. Okay.
You're like, it's slower than, I don't know, it was so slow, and I don't know.
Anyway. Well, no, I think they need to do an alternate cut. Like, I think there's a good cut of that movie to be had. It just was paced terribly. The beginning is too slow. The climax is rushed. So, yeah. I think if you recut it, paste it a little bit better, I would enjoy it more. I haven't watched it since the release, though. So, right. I mean, it might change on rewatch.
It is a long movie.
Yeah, that was just kind of how I felt. I mean, like, it looks visually beautiful. It is stunning to look at. Some of the stuff that, some of the cinematography that he did with it. Was that Roger Deakins?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, that explains it. Okay, my 45 is Interview with the Vampire. Based on Anne Rice's debut novel, Brad Pitt stars as Louis, a reluctant vampire in a homoerotic relationship with Tom Cruise's Lestat. Lestat entraps Louis to him with a surrogate daughter played by a young Kirsten Dunst. Neil Jordan directs this gothic period drama. I just love this one. I kind of love that it's like not explicitly gay. Because like, I don't know. I haven't watched the new version, but they are like just, you know, floating and having sex in it.
You mean the show? From clips on
Twitter. Yeah, the show. And I'm just like, this one's perfect. Like, they clearly, like, I don't know, the way they play it, with the forcing them to play it where, like, straight audiences can watch it and not read it as queer is, I don't know, it just adds a level of subtext to it. And making the subtext text, I'm like, it's fine. I mean, like, I'm sure that there's definitely an audience who will love that. But I don't know. I just love this version, and I don't really feel the need to watch a different version of this. Like, I feel like they nailed it. This is the book. We're good.
That's one I haven't seen.
That's my favorite Neil Jordan movie. He did Crying Game, High Spirits, which was also on this list, and then he created The Borgias. Which is probably not the things, High Spirits and The Borgias, An Interview with the Vampire, probably not the things most people would list from Neil Jordan, but those are my three favorite things from Neil Jordan. My 44 is Insidious. James Wan brings us the story of a boy whose spirit is trapped in the further while entities try to force their way into his body while his family tries to save him. Love this one from Wan. It's almost a riff on like Poltergeist, but I think it's darker and scarier, even though it is still PG-13. So I really like this one.
And it started the universe, right?
It did, yeah. I mean, 2 is the only good sequel. Well, actually, I haven't seen 4, but I didn't like 3 very much. But 2 like ends the story. I don't know why we kept going, you know, like
money,
whatever. Yeah, essentially. But the thing is like, okay, so like the main plot is wrapped up like at the end of 2. We're not going back to these characters again. If we're going to continue to make movies in this universe, the logical thing to explore is how the further works. And the further is not expensive to film in. They purposely made it where, like, you're just filming on, like, empty sound stages with fog and you're holding a lantern. Do you know how cheap that is for a fantasy world? Like, I mean, it's not a budgetary thing. You just spend more time there. And they don't do that. Okay, I gotta flip forward for the next one. Here we are. Okay, my number 43 then is Hellraiser 1987.
Oh, wow.
Clive Barker's debut about a man who summons sadomasochistic sex demons with a magical puzzle box is ripped apart and then convinces his lover, who happens to be his brother's wife, to kill some people to put him back together. A dark and twisted little thriller. I mean, you know, there are like universe building stuff that ends up in here that comes back, and obviously they franchised the shit out of this movie. But this first one is like actually pretty small and self-contained and just really well done.
Funny story, I was at a friend's house when I was really young, and I think his dad probably rented it on VHS and they had it playing, and I like woke up and was freaked out by some of it. So I don't think I've actually ever watched the original since.
I'll show it to you next time we hang out, because I love
it. Yeah, I don't know.
Oh yeah, it's pretty dark and twisted. I mean, Clive Barker is into S&M. He's gay, and like I actually like that doesn't show up a lot in his work until like the more recent ones. It's usually about like straight couples. But Hellraiser is about S&M. It just is.
Right, yeah. It's a lot of leather and
Yeah.
Worms? Was there worms? I don't know.
There's chains. There's chains with fish hooks on them that like I think that's probably what you're thinking of.
I don't know. I saw some crazy stuff, man.
Oh yeah. I mean, like he has like stop motion shit and stuff. The other good ones in the franchise are Hellraiser 2 is actually pretty good. Barker wrote that one, although he didn't direct. And then the recent Hellraiser 2022. Barker wrote it but didn't direct, and that one's pretty good. I haven't seen all the sequels, but those are the two good ones for me. Number 42 is Groundhog Day. Bill Murray stars as Phil, a weatherman trapped in a time loop in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania on Groundhog Day. He learns to be a better man and falls in love. Harold Ramis directs a wonderful film.
It is.
I love that one. Number 41, The Funhouse, 1981. Four teenagers decide to spend a night in the Carnival Funhouse to have sex and witness a murder. Things get out of hand from there. Toe Hooper directs, one of my earliest horror movies. And we had an entire podcast on this one, so I'm not going to talk about it too much more.
We do. Episode 5, guys, if you want to check it out.
So, yeah, that was 41. So
nice. Give me a 40. 40 is another sci-fi horror classic. Alien. The original Alien. In this nice, wonderful book. Chest bursting. I can only imagine what that was like in theaters.
Oh, in
1970s. In
1979.
Oh, yeah. That seeing that for the first time, I would have been, out of my chair. Dude, that's fantastic film. Sigourney Weaver is so good in it, and just the atmosphere is horrific, and just led on to this great franchise that they still want to keep making them and crossovers and stuff. So, but you can't beat the original, or can you? We'll find out later in my list. Number 39 is a great comedy classic. My Cousin Vinny, starring Joe Pesci and Marissa Tomei. Ralph Macchio gets busted for some baked beans that were stolen from a grocery store. But he's set up, and he has to call his cousin Vinny to get him out, who's a lawyer. And there's a lot of hilarious dialogue and twists and turns and classic lines, and I just love it. Number 38 is great sports film, great movie about dreams, Field of Dreams. Kevin Costner plays a man who is hearing voices and decides to build a ball field in the middle of his corn maze at his ranch. And he hears a voice telling him, if you build, they will come. There's a little bit of time travel into this. and some ghosts show up when he builds the field. So there's a little bit of some supernatural stuff going on in this movie, but it all works. And it really seems like it shouldn't, but it does. And it leads up to this fantastic ending. That always kind of gives me tears when he sees his dad. How about a catch, son? Or whatever, you know. It's just, it's real good. All right. Number 37. A lot of sci-fi in this list, I've noticed, for me. This is like a sci-fi romance. But again, it's becoming true. People are ghosting each other. Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. What if you could erase your ex? And there's a service for that in this film. Kate Winslet undergoes it, and she erases Jim Carrey from her memory. Jim Carrey decides to have the same operation to erase Kate Winslet from his memory. Then he decides, while the operation is happening, doesn't want to. So he tries to escape and stop the erasedness. But can you really erase true love, true connection? Fantastic script by Charlie Kaufman. And I think it's one of Jim Carrey's best performances. Kate Winslet is great too. And you have Kirsten Dunst and Mark Ruffalo as like the bumbling stoner people that are like technicians for the service that are doing his surgery. And there's a moment where Jim like opens his eyes and he's like in this cage, or he's in this device. He's wired up to this device where it's supposed to work on his brain, and he can hear what they're doing above him, like dancing around him and stuff naked. So it's just, I don't know. It's a fun film. All right. 36 is a classic from my childhood that I love. That was this character for Halloween. It wasn't the most popular film, but it's kind of got this cult classic status. That is The Rocketeer. A great film. I was just fell in love with the helmet design. Loved the helmet design. And it's basically taking down Nazis. This guy finds a jetpack and Timothy Dalton, man. James Bond himself plays the bad guy in this one. All right. Back to you.
Thank you.
This is a good list.
Yeah, no, I'm excited. Oh, yeah, I was thinking about it when you were talking about the alien chestburster scene. I showed that to my cousins one Halloween, and they somehow didn't know about the chestburster scene, so they had quite the reaction. And then I remember one of my cousins was asleep, and he woke up during the chestburster scene, looked at the TV, and then went right back to sleep.
Yeah, it's horrific, man. You even see like the alien just sitting on a face. It's like,
Okay. My number 40 is 16 Candles. John Hughes directs this zany comedy about a high school girl whose 16th birthday is forgotten by her family. A fun and crazy comedy, a bit dated, but I still love it for its undeniable charm. Yeah, I like this one.
Number three. I wish that guy would end up with her though. The best friend. The nerd.
Oh, the nerdy guy?
Yeah, he's so good.
Yeah. But he ended up with the jock's girlfriend.
Oh yeah.
So, you know.
It worked out, right?
Yeah, I'm fine with them. I mean, one of the dated elements is the talk of sexual assault. But I guess he says he's done with sexual assault, so you know that's good. Number 39 is The Phantom of the Paradise.
Oh yeah, nice.
Brian De Palma's madcap reworking of Phantom of the Opera and Faust set at a rock club is pure distilled comedy horror madness. Paul Williams' music and turn as Swan are great. I just love this movie.
I need to pick that up.
That's a fun one.
I'm waiting though, like, because as soon as I order it, they're gonna do a 4K.
I know they probably are. Okay. My number 38 is A Clockwork Orange. Malcolm McDowell stars Alex, a sociopathic rapist in the near future, who murders a woman during a robbery, is betrayed by his gang and sent to prison, where he undergoes a treatment to prevent him from committing crimes, which robs him of his humanity. A dark dystopian thriller from Stanley Kubrick. And then that goes back in the box because I have one more for this one. Nice. And then 37, which we are real close, is The Big Lebowski. Yeah. The Coen brothers bring us the story of the dude, Jeff Bridges' magnificent stoner bowler, who acts as an unlikely private detective capacity in the spoof of detective movies like The Big Sleep, mixed with splashes of Alice in Wonderland, and steeped in 90s L.A. Hilarious. I made the stack too big, it fell. and then number 36 is Kill Bill, Volumes 1 and 2. The bride was shot and left for dead at her wedding rehearsal. Now she's coming after Bill and the deadly Viper assassination squad who killed her. A revenge epic, equal parts Western and anime, my favorite of Quentin Tarantino's films for sheer insanity. So yeah, what's your 35?
35 is Those Damn Dirty Apes, the original. 1968, Planet of the Apes. This is the collector's edition pack, but epic science fiction film. I prefer this one to any of the other Apes movies. Just a great twist at the end. It's just, you know, you have to kind of suspend your disbelief with the prosthetics, but
I don't know.
Yeah, but I mean, just these apes are like walking around like humans, though. Like, I guess it's because they've evolved.
It's a sci-fi movie.
Yeah, no, you're right. But some people might, you know, compare it to like the new ones and be like, well, you know, but you could argue that Caesar, that universe wasn't as evolved as this one yet.
Mm-hmm.
And those are kind of set before the original 68 version. Just a fantastic sci-fi movie. Charlton Heston is great in it.
Mm-hmm.
What I really found interesting was I saw some footage of like Edward G. Robinson like doing a test footage for one of the characters. Mm-hmm. Like he wasn't in the film, but he had like came in for a day and like a test, makeup test. It's just kind of would have changed some of the like his play. I think he's supposed to play the doctor or one of the,
yeah.
Anyways, I just would have been interesting to see Edward G. Robinson as the doctor. But you can find that clip on YouTube. It's kind of funny. Yeah, just classic. And, you know, my dad and grandpa are big fans, and they turned me on to it, of course, at an early age.
Oh, yeah.
Number 34. It's a holiday classic for me. Silver Linings Playbook. Set in fall, Christmas time-ish, at the ending anyway. Bradley Cooper and Jennifer Lawrence are amazing in this, and it deals with a lot of mental illness and prescription and depression, suicide, stuff like that, therapy. Gives kind of awareness to that when it came out, and just powerhouse performances all around. De Niro's in this as well as Bradley Cooper's dad. And yeah, it's just a great finale sequence. There's a dance scene and just a fantastic film. Really enjoy it. David O. Russell is probably my favorite one of his.
Nice.
Number 33 is this one seems like it should be higher, but it's so good. Road to Perdition. Great movie. Goes overlooked, I think, as far as like, you know, Tom Hanks films. He actually plays a really bad guy in this one, and he's out for redemption to try to like save his son from this life. And Paul Newman is like his last movie on screen. Fantastic. And Jude Law. I always forget Jude Law's in this movie until that moment at the end. I'm like, oh yeah, he's in the movie. I forgot.
Daniel Craig too.
Daniel Craig as well. Yeah. Playing Paul Newman's really son, kind of a loser son. And yeah.
Pre-Bond. Yeah.
Great movie. Yeah. And Sam Mendes, who he did Skyfall, I believe.
Yeah.
Great movie. And based on a comic book. Mm-hmm. Or graphic novel. See, 31. Is that right? 31. Yeah. Pulp Fiction.
Nice.
Quentin Tarantino's second film and the one that really made him a star for the out of order, the non-linear storytelling, the different chapters, interesting characters, not a whole lot of plot, but everything's interesting. I really like John Travolta in this. He's great. Samuel Jackson and him are a great team. Uma Thurman is pretty great too. And fantastic turn by Bruce Willis. He shows up in the middle of the movie and just great. I mean, it's epic dialogue. The only problem I have with the film is Tarantino himself showing up in the film. And I mean, I get it. Maybe he's going for humor with that scene. I just feel like, I don't know. It's kind of an ego trip. That's my only gripe with the film. But other than that, I think it still holds up.
My favorite performance from him is From Dusk Till Dawn. Everything else, I'm like, yeah, you're fine. But that one was really fun.
He just, I don't know. I just think there's no reason for him to show up in the movie and say a bunch of N-words. But, you know.
No, yeah, that was.
I get it. True. I mean, it's just, I guess this is how he is. But it's also the 90s. But I don't know. It's just, it takes me out of the movie now. When I watch it now, it takes me out of the movie. I'm like,
that's true. That's probably the scene Spike Lee was talking about too. Because I had always thought it was the Samuel Jackson dialogue, but.
No, I'm totally cool with that. The director shows up in the film to like hook him up with the wolf, but he like drops this monologue with like these, like at least two N-words and stuff. I was like, it's just so,
yeah, no, that was
for like comedy reasons. Like, I can't really justify it looking at it now. Yeah. It's like, it kind of throws me out of the movie, doesn't ruin it as completely, but it's just, that's like my only gripe with the film.
Yeah, yeah, I always forget about that part.
Yeah, I do too. Until I'm like, oh,
oh yeah, yeah. Then you're watching it and you're like, oh yeah, okay, yeah, that's true. That is a good criticism, and actually, like, I understand Spike Lee's point now if he was talking about that. Because I was always interpreting it as the Samuel L. Jackson dialogue, and I was like, but that's a performance. You know, like, mm-hmm. Samuel L. Jackson is doing a performance of an angry black man in order to scare these people. So I thought that that made sense. I didn't remember that scene, but so, like,
In Django, they're all slave owners and they're really horrible people, so it makes sense too.
Yeah, yeah. Same with Hateful Eight. I mean, like, yeah, that one is kind of a joke too, but like, they're all racist assholes, so like, you know, it was fine. But yeah, sorry, that was just a tangent.
No, it's cool. I mean, like, the director like puts himself in that scene, and
so, I know, yeah. That role does need to be there. They, I mean, like, they do need somebody to play that part. But yeah, I don't know that he needed to drop the N-word, and I don't know that it needed to be Tarantino himself doing it. But who knows? Maybe they just couldn't find somebody. I mean, like, that seems to happen a lot where when the director steps in. It's like in Pop Star, it's the director's penis, right? In the
I haven't seen it.
Oh, okay. There's a scene where he signs somebody's penis, and so the director jumps in, and that's his penis.
But other than that, I do enjoy Pulp Fiction, and it's still groundbreaking in the way that it was storytelling, and it really put that Tarantino verse afoot.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's it for me for this part. I have five more left, I believe.
Yeah. Okay. My 35 is 28 days later.
Oh, wait. I'm sorry. I missed one. I skipped
over. Okay, go for it.
I have a box set. So 32 is Aliens.
Ah, okay.
And then 31 is Pulp Fiction. But Aliens was 32. Everything is elevated. It's a war movie, really. James Cameron stepped in, the director, and changed it to this epic ensemble war piece, but still gives it this heart with bringing in like Ripley and Newt's relationship. Fantastic. The alien, the mother queen. It's really a battle of mothers at the end. Mm-hmm. When you have the hive mother versus Ripley.
Oh, yeah.
Who's, you know, they're kind of battling each other. Just everything's upped. And I heard that Cameron's pitch was, he wrote on the whiteboard, like, alien and put the S in, as a money sign. Which, I think that's hilarious.
I mean, he wasn't wrong.
No, he was not wrong. It was
I mean, Aliens is really the movie that like made it a fucking franchise. So
yeah, it's true. All of it. But then Pulp Fiction was 31. So now back to you.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
No, that was good. I'm glad we got to hear about Aliens, because we would have been left in suspense.
People would have been like, what the hell, man? You skipped 32.
Number 35 is 28 Days Later. Cillian Murphy wakes up in the midst of a zombie apocalypse and scours an empty London for fellow survivors, eventually teaming up with Naomi Harris and Brendan Gleeson to form a makeshift family. He is pushed to the brink when the group encounters a group of soldiers. Dark and grimy, in part due to them shooting on videotape, an excellent zombie movie. I don't think I mentioned by Danny Boyle, my favorite Danny Boyle movie. So, yeah, really good one.
Nice. And I think it was low budget, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was relatively low budget.
Came out around like the handheld camera time, I think. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it's really grimy, like, but it adds to the aesthetic, I feel like.
Yeah.
Number 34 is Sleepy Hollow, 1999. Tim Burton's makes Ichabod Crane, Johnny Depp, into a forensic scientist sent to Sleepy Hollow to solve a series of murders committed by the Headless Horseman. An excellent reinvention of the Washington Irving story, a creepy storybook of a movie. Very Hammer horror inspired. Christina Ricci's really fun. I love, there's a lot of really good people in this one. I love that Christopher Walken is the Headless Horseman, has no lines of dialogue, and just goes, my number 33 is 2001, A Space Odyssey. Stanley Kubrick and Arthur C. Clarke contemplate the origin of our consciousness and the next phase of human evolution, a trippy 60s sci-fi masterpiece. This movie is a religious experience while high in a movie theater. And I stand by that.
Yeah, it's hard to believe that was in the 60s.
I know, right? They were thinking of putting in voiceover. And at the last second, Stanley Kubrick was like, no. And he cut it all. He didn't use the score that they made for it. He just used classical music. And he didn't tell the composer. The composer found out at the screening.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, like, he was right to do it. It's just, it's kind of a dick move to not tell him about it, you know?
Well, that's probably a studio choice, right? And they're like, we have to pay this guy. So we'll just let him compose, I guess, right?
Well, no, I mean, like,
and not use it?
Yeah. I just feel like, you know, if you're not going to, it's fine to not use the score. But you should tell the composer before they go to the premiere and expect to hear their music in it, and then find out that their
score is not. Yeah, give a courtesy, like, hey.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, it happens. It happens that, like, you know, stuff like that. But, like, they should at least be told. I mean, I know it's a tough conversation. Don't get me wrong. But, like, I feel like it's a tougher conversation when you don't tell them to go into the movie.
Yeah, that's pretty bad. Yeah, that's a bad look.
I mean, that's not like the worst thing Stanley Kubrick did. I feel like torturing Shelley Duvall was way worse. But number 32 is Van Helsing. Hugh Jackman's Van Helsing battles Dracula, his brides, and the Wolfman while attempting to stop them from using the Frankenstein monster in a machine that will give life to Dracula's children. Stephen Sommers' big budget camp fest bombed at the box office, but nestled into my heart. I love this movie.
That's awesome.
I'm pretty sure this movie is the reason why he didn't get The Mummy 3, and simultaneously why The Mummy 3 sucks. But yeah, love this one. And then number 31 is Chinatown. Jack Nicholson's Jake Geetz sets out to solve a mystery involving the L.A. waterworks in the 70s film noir, directed by Roman Polanski and co-starring Faye Dunaway and John Huston. A masterpiece in pessimism. Because, oh my God.
Yeah.
Okay, so that was 31. So what's your
okay, 30? Number 30 is a Robert Redford-led baseball movie that I adore, The Natural, directed by Barry Levinson. An amazing score. He plays a baseball phenomenal early childhood prodigy, pretty much, who disappears and comes back and plays one final season. There's more to it than that. There's a nice little like murder mystery in between. Leads us to an epic conclusion that I really enjoy. And Glenn Close is also exceptional in this film.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to close the window real quick.
All right. How dare you leave while I talk?
Well, somebody's playing with their kid outside. So
this year on this next one.
Yes. Okay.
All right. Number 29 is Michael Mann's Manhunter.
Ooh, nice.
This is the introduction to Hannibal Lecter on the big screen, mm-hmm. played by Brian Cox. William Peterson is fantastic as Will. Just a awesome, just the way that Michael Mann lit this thing, like a giallo almost. Mm-hmm. And it's just, there's so much epicness and the satisfactory conclusion with the In Legata La Vida, the rock song. And I don't know, I just, this one really started the Michael Mann this that would become, you know, a staple in his other films like Heat and Thief. Well, actually, Thief was out before this one, but just he just really put this nice little spin on the Hannibal Lecter book. I mean, I haven't read the book, but I mean, I heard it wasn't really accurate.
It's interesting looking at it because the Silence of the Lambs like is very accurate to the like gothic trappings of the story. So to see them like ignore that completely and just do their own thing is really interesting.
This becomes like this serial murder mystery, you know, Miami Vice infused, because Michael Mann had a hand into the 80s series Miami Vice. And so he's really took that and put this, I guess it's probably more of an MTV version of the Silence of the Lambs, I guess. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it wasn't a big success, but I think it's really gone on to be more of like a cult film. And I was blown away. The next one is from a collection, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, the third installment in the Indiana Jones series. Having Sean Connery come in and play Indiana Jones' father was just genius. They have so many funny comedic moments together, his father and son bickering at each other. And it's really a great story of, like just that, a father and son relationship and really what life is all about and searching for something all your life. And then the cup of life, the cup of everlasting life. I just like the story, their whole like possible religious aspect. They had a nice quest in this one. Just overall, and you're fighting Nazis too. I mean, Indiana Jones versus Nazis is a win-win always.
Yeah.
Let's see. Oh yeah, 27. Getting down to the end here.
Yeah.
Tom Cruise is a sports agent. Grasping to the, I don't know, he's very desperate and his life is in turmoil, but he's a sports agent trying to keep his draft pick, played by Cuba Gooding Jr. and Jerry Maguire. Renee Zellweger is also in this, and this has the classic Cameron Crowe soundtrack. He directed this one, Cameron Crowe. And just fantastic lines in here. Show me the money. You have me a hello. Extremely romantic film. Highly recommend Jerry Maguire. And Tom Cruise actually gets to act in this one, not really run. He does run, though. He does run.
He doesn't run in my Interview with the Vampire either. So
he doesn't run. He runs in Jerry Maguire. He does.
I don't think he runs in
Interview with the Vampire. So
he gets to act in Interview with the Vampire. It's very steamy gag.
He's a great actor. I just wish he did more of that. I mean, I really, he is. As much as I love his stunts and
Eyes Wide Shut, man.
Fantastic actor. Yeah. 26 is. Blockbuster classic, really the one that started the blockbuster, Jaws, Steven Spielberg. It was genius to not show the shark until like later on in the film. The suspense is really there still to this day. And it's pretty much the Citizen Kane of blockbuster films. The way that he uses Hitchcockian Dolly shot with Roy Schneider looking up at a newspaper and having that cool Dolly zoom shot and the suspenseful score by John Williams. Just a couple notes. Dun-dun. You know, it's just fantastic and really, really bloody for like a, you know, PG film. I know the ratings were different back in the 70s, but it's just such a great film. And Robert Shaw is great. Roy Scheider is great. It is a fantastic summer film. Still holds up. All right. That ends my list for this episode.
Ooh,
at okay. 26. So back to you, Tom, for the rest of yours.
All right. My number 30 is Creature from the Black Lagoon. A group of scientists searching for fossils come upon a living gill man. I love this. I love the score, the suspense, and the wonderful sets. And also the costume is really fun. I love this movie.
It's really great because it's black and white too. It's like really, I don't know. I feel like if it was in color, it wouldn't hold up as much.
Yeah, it wouldn't work. I mean, I think that about all the Universal Monster movies, like except for like obviously Phantom of the Opera, which is in color, the 40s film, not the 20s. But But like, yeah, the other ones, I'm like, I don't want them in color. Like, I've actually even seen like Frankenstein colorized, and I'm like, ooh, don't do that. Okay, number 29, Suspiria, 1977. Dario Argento's masterpiece finds Jessica Harper joining a ballerina academy run by witches. One of the teachers is Joan Bennett of Dark Shadows. I love the brutal murders that reach the level of artistry, the bright colors, and the frantic goblin score. Number 28 is Gladiator. Ridley Scott's epic follows Maximus as he is taken from his position as a Roman general, sold into slavery, becomes a gladiator, and defies the emperor who made him a slave. Russell Crowe and Joaquin Phoenix are excellent. My number 27 is Bram Stoker's Dracula. Francis Ford Coppola adapts Dracula for the 90s, starring Gary Oldman, Winona Ryder, Anthony Hopkins, Keanu Reeves, Tom Watts, and Cary Elwes, featuring fantastic set design and a haunting score. This version of Dracula makes the story operatic. Yeah, 1992. And then my 26 is Creepshow.
Mm.
Stephen King writes and George Romero directs 5 segments in this anthology film based on campy horror comics of the 50s. A zombie wants his Father's Day cake. Leslie Nielsen buries his wife and lover up to their necks in sand at high tide. A Scroogey man is attacked by cockroaches. King himself is consumed by green moss from a meteorite and a spoof of Lovecraft's The Color Out of Space. Very, very fun. I love this one. This one's from Shout Factory.
Have you seen the epic like 4K box set of that that's coming out?
I know. I kind of want to get it. But I'm also like, I did just get this one. Not well, it's been like a year or a year and a half now, but
yeah,
I'm probably going to get it. You know me, I'm probably going to get it.
It's pretty high on your list.
Yeah.
Is that all?
Yeah, so that was it. That was 26. So yeah, we got
wow.
We went like a half hour longer because I rambled about Batman for 15 minutes. So
it's all good. James Gunn, again, if you're listening, please let us know, reach out, and we'll get in touch with Tom. But that'll do it for this week. And we have one more week of we're heading into our top 25 next week. So
Yeah. Be
sure to watch it next week and let us know below in the comments what you thought of this week's episode and the movies that we presented and the interesting takes we had on like Pulp Fiction, Blade Runner 2049, and wherever else we went. And yeah, let's keep it going. And thanks again for watching. Peace out.
For more Return of the Disc, visit returnofthedisc.com.
Check out the audio version of today's show, available on all major podcast platforms.
And be sure to subscribe to the YouTube channel,